Welcome to The Line, the sports podcast from PR Week.
Hi, and welcome to The Line, the PR Week sports podcast in collaboration with Cake, recorded here at the HKX building in St Pancras. We are talking sex, violence, booze and drugs, and that's before we even get on to brown paper envelopes full of cash and dawn raids. So we're talking about crisis and crisis management in sport. Sometimes I think, Danny, that I get interested in sport for the crisis and then stay for the sport sometimes. It's quite often you see, you know, we're going to talk about Ben Stokes and the video that we've probably all seen at this point, Wayne Rooney, drink and drive story. The FA's Mark Sampson story's response to that, the sacking of Sam Allardyce, Jerry Barton and his betting habit. Then we go back to Tiger Woods and the fire hydrant. The list of sports crises is a long one. So how are we going to do it? Who we got?
Well, we're very lucky. We've got Phil Hall in the studio, and Phil now runs one of the biggest PR agencies in the UK, PHA Associates. And Phil, of course, was editor of News of the World back in the 90s for quite a few years, and Hello magazine as well. So he can see crises from both sides of the divide. So Phil, let's start by talking about the crisis that's really hit the headlines in the past few weeks. Mr. Stokes of the England cricket team. Do you feel that crisis has peaked? Is it kind of going to carry on? How serious is it?
I don't think it has peaked because we don't know the facts yet. And I think this is half the problem, really. It doesn't necessarily suit journalists, and I speak as a former one, to have all the facts, because the less facts you have, the longer the story will run for, because clearly bits will come out bit by bit. But I do think, I think the ECB have handled this pretty well, really, because they haven't been drawn into long conversations about it. They've made a very short, sharp statement, and they're clearly now investigating or waiting to find out the result of a police investigation.
It's a strange one, isn't there? Because there was this killer video, you know, this video I think The Sun got hold of, which is very explicit. Do you think the video has changed the nature of these sort of crises?
I do. I think citizen journalists now has made it very difficult for anything to go away, really. And you know, people say the camera never lies, but it does, because, you know, let's make up the scenario that actually, you know, Stokes was baited inside the pub. He was being attacked with a bottle and he struck out. Well, that's not necessarily shown on a camera. So one of the great problems is you're horrified when you see that video, but again, you don't know the full facts.
The other bit to that, as you say, the start, we know the end of the story. We see the right hook, but the beginning is cloudy, and that's where the doubt is.
Yeah, and I think there's clearly a principle here. You know, should he and Hales have been out drinking 2 days, I think it was, before the next big match against the West Indies? And that clearly is probably unforgivable for a top sportsman. But then, of course, they do get picked on, and it, you know, it can run out of hand very quickly. We've seen that many times. And so, I do think you're right. You see the end. You see the sort of the last picture, which horrifies you, but we don't know what's gone on before.
And Piers Morgan was the person who broke that, or seemed to break a story, yeah, there in terms of the...
I've got to tell you, Piers, there's nobody anywhere in this country who's got better contacts in cricket than Piers. He's brilliantly stoked them by inviting many top players to play in his local pub cricket match once a year, and he's kept those relationships, and he's very good at networking, as Piers. And so he would have got that from right inside the England camp. And, I have to say, I would lean towards it, because Stokes just lashing out for the sake of it does seem rather unlikely, I have to say.
And you say that the ECB appears to have handled it well. Do you think that it'll get better now and that Ben Stokes will go to the Ashes?
I think he'll go to the Ashes. I think there'll be an awful lot of pressure on the authorities. I'm talking about the police and the investigating bodies, because the newspapers are watching very closely, and the police don't behave normally in these situations, in my experience, where they know they're under the spotlight. They move a lot fast, but it depends, of course, on what the facts are. It depends whether it's conclusive.
Quite often in these sporting crises, there's the media handling side of things, and then there's the legal side of things. There's often a legal case that goes along with the media, and there is indeed in the Ben Stokes case and quite a few other examples. When is it right to go legal, or when should you not go legal?
I mean, I think if you've got a long-term relationship with the press and you need to keep that going in the long term, then going legal should be almost a no-no, certainly legally against the newspapers. Clearly, when it's a police investigation, I think my advice always first port of call is to say there's a police investigation going on. We're making no comment until until we know the outcome of that. But going legal against the press, all it does is wind them up. You end up with, for the next 5 years, finding somebody with a bit of a grudge against you. And I also think going legal is sometimes seen as an admission of guilt. You know, why would you go legal if you're an innocent man? And sometimes, yes, you've got to go through the pain of 2 or 3 months of things being investigated and your life being turned upside down. But actually, generally, the truth is outed at the end. And I think going legal is an absolute no-no.
Yeah, for quite a few years, we had the injunctions and the super injunctions. That was largely to do with footballers having affairs, I seem to remember.
Yeah.
John Terry and Ashley Cole and all of that. Yeah. Have we seen the end of those days of injunctions?
I think so. I think the last one was Ryan Giggs, and that caused a lot of controversy at the time. And I think we have seen the end of those super injunctions. I think people have become aware that what the damage it does to the individual's reputation. But it does depend on the circumstances. Again, I've certainly been involved in cases where we went for a super injunction because somebody's health was at risk, or there was a child at risk in a particular situation I can think of, where a newspaper were digging around actually in an area which would affect the children's future. So there are still circumstances, but I think that they're generally no longer being pursued.
And going back a couple of decades, you were on the other side of the fence. You were editor of News of the World, and presumably you broke big stories, big crises about sports people. Did you feel like you had to get that person? Did you have to go after them?
No, it just doesn't work. It's impossible. I mean, there were rumours about a particularly well-known commentator that at the time, and we looked at it. It's impossible. You unless you've got somebody on the inside, it's very, very difficult. I mean, clearly that changed when phone hacking came along and there were some illegal activities taking place. But certainly in my time, and I left in 2000, you had to have an inside track. So probably the most notorious story I did was Lawrence Dallaglio and the cocaine shame. And he told us the entire story. I mean, we were accused later of a honey trap, which was nonsense because it was a guy and a girl reporter who met him to talk about his commercial deals he was doing, and he freely started talking about what he was doing. But it was interesting because the reaction of the public was to the paper was terrible. We lost circulation over it. People don't like to see their heroes torn apart, and it was a very difficult one. And we were due to run a second part, and on that occasion we actually spoke to the rugby union authorities who were criticising us and said, well, let's show you the film that we've got. And we showed them the film, and we made an agreement that they would say no more and we would say no more. So it's tricky.
And in Lawrence's case, it must have been fairly well handled on his side of things, because he did end up being England captain again. And
he did. He got accused or prosecuted for bringing the game into disrepute. So I think they felt he had behaved badly, which he had, just by talking to strangers in such an open and
naive,
cavalier and naive way. And but you're right. I mean, the punishment's got to fit the crime. I don't think he hadn't harmed other people, third parties, and I think suspending him was the right thing. And when he got his England captaincy back, it was the right thing too.
What's there's always a commercial angle when you've got someone of that such a status. They come with sponsors, and sponsors quite often use them as role models and position them as role models. And do you think that is tricky and dangerous territory for a sponsor?
I think it's very difficult. I think what happens when you have that sort of role model, it makes him a target. It puts a target on the individual's back as far as the press are concerned. Especially, it depends on the circumstances, but if you're trying to paint somebody as being whiter than white and very sort of family orientated, and you're projecting that, and then suddenly he's cheating on his wife and misbehaving, then you've made them a target. And it's interesting these days, with the way the privacy laws have changed in the last 15 years. So, certainly when the Red Tops would do a story about anybody having a relationship outside their marriage, now people are entitled to their privacy. It's changed. And unless you've got a real lever to run the story, it's very difficult. You've got to have this person's taking £1 million and conning the public into thinking he's, this perfect paragon of virtue, when actually is something else, then you've got a reason to run the story. But without that, it's very difficult.
So actually the commercial angle is a lever that is handed to the media. That's the route that they'll go.
But I think actually I think the balance has tipped more in favour of the PR and protecting people now than in favour of the newspapers because of the privacy laws and because actually the public have tired of that type of story. It's got to have something that, you know, has a real merit to it. Other, just a, you know, sex for sex sake in newspapers no longer is in vogue, I think.
The Line is sponsored by Cake, the Havas Sport and Entertainment Agency.
What about when it moves from that sort of personal realm? So you've got, you know, a John Terry or a Rooney or a Stokes, and then it moves into becoming more of a corporate issue for the governing body. What's it like being in the sort of eye of the storm when a story breaks like
it's
that?
It's very difficult because the corporate body, to have a good profile, needs to have relationships with journalists going forward. And of course, journalists will, you know, they'll work with the corporate bodies, so they'll do positive stories about them when they ask them to. Sometimes, maybe when a story hasn't got quite that newsworthiness, they'll do them a favour and do that positive story. And then, of course, you get a crisis. They want that favour returned. They want to know what's going on. And that can be very difficult because at the end of the day, the corporate body's got to protect the organisation and sometimes the individual. Again, I found very difficult sometimes is getting the truth. You know, people go into denial when they're accused of doing bad things, or they haven't told, you know, partners or commercial partners that, you know, the full story. So from a PR perspective, it can be very difficult to represent somebody unless you know the full facts. I mean, it's the first thing you ever say when you're representing a corporate company, we must know the full facts. The PR has to be at the, you know, the top table to understand the full dilemma. And so it can be very difficult defending people without having that absolute assurance that they've got the whole story.
That's always the scene in the film, isn't it? Well, tell us everything.
Yeah.
That's always the exciting
true,
bit.
It's true because, and also one of the difficulties is often the person who's the target or the victim of this press story doesn't necessarily realise the significance of something. So they won't realise that maybe this commercial deal is under threat because of, you know, the way they've behaved. And so trying to get them to realise the severity can sometimes be very difficult.
And do you have a kind of a Phil Hall checklist? You know, if a sports person comes to you and goes, Phil, you've got to help me here, I'm in the middle of a storm, and they tell you what's happened, do you go through a list of things to do?
When I started, I did. And now I've just torn the whole thing up because I realised every single one is different. It depends on the individual, how strong they are. You know, some people are wilting under it. Some people are more determined because of it. So it depends on that. It depends on the stakeholders. You know, it could be the football club. It could be the wife. It could be the family. It could be, and depends how they're reacting to something. Because, you know, people used to say, well, you know, the strongest, most powerful word in the English language is sorry. So you say sorry and, you know, it goes away. Well, it doesn't, because the newspapers then say, well, actually, you've now admitted it, you're free game. So they'll go after other stories about you. So it's, you know, the times to say sorry and move on, move the agenda on, have long passed. And so, there is no rule now. It depends entirely on the circumstances. But the most important thing, going back to journalistic values, is knowing the facts and being able to be sure the facts are true.
So you have to get your client to tell you everything, which must be difficult.
It is difficult. And sometimes, you know, we use lawyers to do that. You know, we'll find when they're in a lawyer's office, they suddenly realise the severity of what's happening and asking, you know, very direct questions and very detailed questions. You get the sort of answers that you need to better give proper advice.
And what do you do if you think your client might be lying to you?
Just go completely quiet. So no statements. I mean, I've had many times where a client said, well, I think we should put a statement out saying, you know, X, Y, Z, and I'm thinking that it just doesn't make sense. It doesn't add up. And so my advice then is always to say nothing and try to get to know the client a little bit better, try and build the trust. And once they trust you, they will tell you more. And I've worked at a couple of football clubs where we were there long term, you know, one with 3 or 4 years, and we got very close to a lot of the players. And I could talk to, you know, others. So one player's in trouble, I could talk to the others and say, is he telling me the truth? And you know, try and work together to solve the problem.
Those journalistic relationships that you talked about, I mean, the there is a difference between, and we're talking about sport here, there's a difference between a sporting journalist contact and the general news desk context. And quite often when you're at a story, and we mentioned the Freddie Flintoff and the pedalo story, and that was relating to how much he was drinking. The cricket pack at the time came into a lots of sort of criticism because they didn't comment on it, and sometimes they were out drinking with him. But that was seen as relationship building.
Yeah,
and then the news, when the new, it became a news story, then it changed and the whole tone of the thing alters.
And Alistair Campbell did something similar, didn't he, when he went on tour with the British Lions. And yeah, it's and he put the opposite, in fact. He tried to keep a distance. So when, and then every little problem was being magnified. It's very difficult because a sports journalist can have a very easy day if a cricketer, for instance, is prepared to help him. So Stokes says, I'm going to skittle New Zealand out for less than 100. It's a two-page spread. Life's very easy. They can enjoy themselves. So they don't want to fall out with that cricketer or that manager because of the, you know, the, he's helping them do their job. But when the big story breaks, it becomes very, very difficult, because certainly as an editor, I'd expect my cricket correspondent to know exactly, you know, what was going on. I mean, we had two or three very good cricket writers, including Richie Beno, and, you know, you would expect them to tell the truth. But they've got to wake up the following day and then go back into sports mode with a journalist. And so it's very, very difficult. And then, of course, the news guy comes in, and I've had two situations in my career, actually. One, when I was editing a newspaper, where we've done a showdown with a particular sports personality we're doing a story with, and inside the house was one of my reporters advising him how to keep the story out of the paper. So very difficult. And on both occasions, I did not dismiss the journalist. I just realised how difficult it is for him in that situation. So what often happens in newspaper offices is you'll have a room where these stories are being discussed, and it doesn't go anywhere outside, so nobody in the sports department knows that a newspaper's doing a story about a sports personality, because they know it's a conflict of interest.
Can you think of an example where a sports crisis has been handled really well, either by you or by somebody else, where a player has had a tough time and yet been quite quickly rehabilitated? I'm thinking maybe Maria Sharapova, who seems to have come back quite strong in the world of tennis.
Yeah, I mean, it's an old joke, really, in PR circles, which is, you know, the best PR in football is to win football matches. Because if you win matches, a lot of the problems go away. And I think that's very true with people like Sharapova, you know, major, major stars. Tiger Woods, this is where it went wrong, really, for him, in that he didn't recover his form. You know, she's struggling a little bit, but she's certainly starting to play better. And the advice over and over again is to just go back and play. Sport is so powerful, and a successful sports person is so revered and loved around the world that anything can be forgiven. Yeah. In many ways, they have more power than anybody else in the media spotlight, because, you know, suddenly here you are, you know, John Terry's case, he lost his England captaincy. He started playing the best form of his life for Chelsea. They won the league championship. I think they won the Champions League. And suddenly everything's forgotten. It's repatriated. The public forgive a sports star. And I don't necessarily subscribe to this role model theory. I think those days have gone, really. I think these guys are multimillionaires. They are corporations in their own way, really, and I think these days I'm not sure the public expect particular perfect behaviour from them.
Don't expect them to be gentlemen anymore. And like,
no, I think so. I think so. I mean, there are cases with something like Stokes in public. That film makes it something very significant. But I think a lot of things these days the public are prepared to, you know, forget, because they admire the star so much.
It's almost like you could say, you know, I was thinking about who would. The Tiger Woods story, I think, was a big moment, because it was a sort of realization of the distance between the sort of human being and the brand. And the brand had been cultivated by Nike and Woods' advisors so brilliantly that actually no human being could live up to that sort of the poster version of him. And there's a feeling that the best endorsees you don't really hear from, or sorry, endorsers. So you've got people, I was just thinking, well, Beckham, K Kate Moss, Tiger Woods, they're probably the most
yes.
successful brand ambassadors of the last 20 years. And they're at their most successful when they don't say anything.
You're right. That's so true. It's very hard, isn't it? I mean, you look at Tiger Woods when he held that press conference, and I think he thought he could just say whatever he wanted and it would be forgotten. That would be the end of it. And of course, they analyze every word and they pick up the contradictions, and then pictures start to surface because it's an open invitation. Because you're saying, I'm now going to tell you the truth. The truth is, I've been a naughty boy, but not that bad. And then suddenly pictures start appearing red tops in America, and he gets destroyed again. So, you know, in many ways, I think it's a shame that people can't say sorry. But I think sometimes they just have to say, you know, let the press play it out. And, you know, maybe by saying nothing, it's an admission of guilt to some. But I think generally the truth comes out, even if it's 2 or 3 months later. You know, the score does get settled.
So, in that situation, is it different from a corporate crisis? Because a corporate crisis, generally, the advice is to get all of the bad news out as quickly as you can, for the CEO to appear, to be very open, to apologise, to be seen to be sorting things out. Is that different for a sports star?
I think. I think it's, you know, being blunt about it, it's about money. And, you know, follow the money, as they always say. And if you've got a corporation that's in meltdown and you don't stem the flow of the blood, it's going to hemorrhage until it's too late. So you really do have to get out there. And you know, sometimes, you know, in the case of Ryanair, it's almost impossible. It's quite clear he didn't realize the scale of the problem. Mm. So he's gone out there. Now people somehow think he's been misleading. I just think the things run away with him, and clearly the business is not being run as efficiently as we all thought it was. And but I would still say he was right to go out there, because if he hadn't, I think that the trust has gone completely with the public. So corporate, you do have to get on the front foot.
It's interesting that the sort of speed of decision making. I mean, one of the features of the England or the FA over the last year under Martin Glenn seems to be a real desire to be sort of thrillingly decisive when bad news breaks. And you certainly saw that around Sam Allardyce. You know, he was, the story ran on the Sunday. And I think what happened is that the League Managers Association had a golf day on the Monday. And also all the football journalists were at that when the FA announced. It was seen to be very quick, but whether it was right or not,
of course, Sam Allardyce is now suing the FA for damages for the speed at which they reacted. It's very difficult, because in that circumstance, I would argue that even if the story is wrong, it made his position very difficult. I'm not sure they should have sacked him, but I think he could have been suspended. There were plenty of people around the game who could step in and take his position. But I think it's very difficult, because all the story now was about Sam Allardyce and was he misbehaving, TV, newspapers, all focused on it. There's no way he could carry on managing the next match and the match after that without questions being asked. And the worst thing, you know, in my experience, when you've got a problem, is putting any sports personality in front of a pack, because the pack become very brave. There's no longer, you know, one person who's going to be blamed for asking the question. And they get together and they sort out the questions beforehand, and one asks one question, one asks the... So it's very tricky. And then, you know, very often you're in the spotlight, they're reading your body language. And of course, you know, whether you're innocent or not, you're going to be very uncomfortable. And so I think it's a very difficult situation. I don't think he could have carried on. But as for sacking him permanently, I think that's questionable.
Yeah. I'm going to bring us right the way back to the beginning. I mean, thinking of sports stars as brands, the fact that, you know, PR people manage stars as brands, we like our stars to be a bit flawed, don't we? We like them, you know, that's one of the reasons that we kind of like crises as well.
It's true. It's the human side of the people, isn't it? The Freddie Flintoff is a classic example. I mean, he's so popular, and he did some pretty crazy, silly things. And also, you don't want bland role models, do you, for a brand? So this is where, you know, Nike and one or two of the others, I think, are very clever. You know, they support their stars through thick and thin. You know, Tiger Woods was an exceptional case, really. But I do think, the flawedness and this sort of slightly naughty boy is what people, you know,
relate to,
and it's interesting. You know, the stories run on those sort of people because they're a little bit out of the ordinary. You know, I think one of the exceptions to the rule might be somebody like Frank Lampard, who, you know, if you look at him and his record at Chelsea and what an incredible role model he's been and how well behaved he's been, and, you know, there's never been barely a negative word written.
No,
about
the only
him.
There was that, I think he was involved in that post 9/11. Wasn't he involved with John Terry? And oh no, there was a La Manga drinking session, I think, way back.
I think, and
yeah. You've got to be careful, Phil, because he's a Chelsea nerd.
So. Yeah, so I know all these.
You're on dodgy territory.
I think it was. It's probably a News of the World story, actually. But again, you know, for a man who's lived in the spotlight like he has, remarkable, really. But still interesting enough, I think, to be a role model and to be somebody that the corporates will buy into.
Well, it's interesting. There's a sort of a strand of some of the big sportswear brands, particularly when they're selling women's wear, they are going a different route. They're not using sports people. They're using people like Rihanna, Puma, and Rita Ora, Adidas, and there is a whole area because they feel that they're more interesting. They're more flawed, but more, let's say, honest with their flaws.
There's less risk of something breaking about.
You're taking the sort of the tension out of that, aren't you? Because you know that they're probably going to be in the headlines at some point. That's why you like them. But as you say, we like human beings. We like people.
I came by a sports clothes shop yesterday, and the main range on sale was Bjorn Borg.
Yeah,
you know, probably
on the back of that. But you look at McEnroe, for instance, and what a bad boy he was, and now we all think he's the best thing since sliced bread.
Most interesting tennis player of all time, as a result.
Yeah. Most interesting commentator, as a result. Yeah. So, you know, you've got to be careful what you wish for, I think. But we shouldn't forget that newspapers are about news. That's on the day, something happening. They're not really thinking about long term, and they don't necessarily think as badly of the star that they're writing about that they, you know, as the words seem to portray. It's, you know, it's part of the business. And you look at football, actually, in particular, and the more interesting characters are the more controversial ones. You know, it is Mourinho who gets all the coverage. Why? It's not because he's, you know, he's a sort of plain Sam. He's out there saying something that's interesting and you know, sometimes questionable.
What you made your career as a journalist on a Sunday. I think that's fair to say. You know, that's what you're famous for. The role of Sunday papers and the way in which they can take a story and make it a bigger story. Because I'm interested in, we call it crisis management. We rush to that word quite easily, and sometimes it's just there's stories come and go. I mean, what's your take on the role of Sundays then, when you were there, but also now? Are they as powerful as they used to be?
I don't think the papers are as powerful because they're not as well staffed or as well resourced, but still, we still say, can we get past the Sunday on a crisis? So, you know, the job of the Sunday paper is always to follow up the daily papers and get the big new angle on a running story. They were always the biggest sellers of any paper. So we're still looking at that. We still look at that. We still want to try and get past the Sunday. And generally, if you get past the Sunday and there's nothing in the Sunday paper of the week, the story's been running, the story starts to fade and disappear very quickly. The newspapers, as I said, are under-resourced. They need PRs more than ever, which, you know, is good for our profession, but sad in many ways because it means that, you know, they have to compromise a lot of the time. And we get a lot of situations where people come to us with stories where they haven't got the facts, you know, they've heard a rumour, you know, and they're looking for the PR to give them the story, and clearly that's not our role. So it's, you know, there's a lot less crisis-type stories in the newspapers than there ever was before, and it's why, you know, so many of the pages are filled with politics. There's not, you know, the investigative work that the Sunday papers used to do. I mean, we would put two or three people on a, for instance, I did a number of the cricket scandals and betting scandals, and we'd put two or three people on those stories for 3 or 4 months at a time. And there was no pressure on them to deliver a story. They were just to go away and just eke every sort of angle out of it and see whether it would stand up. But that doesn't happen anymore. They've got 1 week on a story and that's it, because the resources won't stretch.
We must talk about social media and the effect that's had on crises. I guess it's changed the handling of an average crisis. And of course, you've got the ability now for the players to tweet themselves maybe under your advice or not under your advice. How has that changed your world?
It's made a massive difference. I mean, in my experience, chairmen of football clubs pay more attention to social media than they do to a newspaper, which is remarkable because the newspapers have got 100 times more people reading them. It's because it's on the moment, and it's because they feel a connection because they're tweeting themselves or they've got Instagrams themselves, and so they feel this sort of need to respond. And actually, my view is always it's like the man in the pub. He always had a view on Chelsea or West Ham, but you didn't react to it. You're only reacting because you're reading it now, and it somehow feels like it's in print. And they shouldn't be reacting to it. You know, they should switch off their social media.
Is it always a bad thing for the person to react to social media?
I think so. Because what are they gaining from it? You know, people may say, they feel more connected to the fans. And I think it goes back to what I said a short while ago. Go win the football match and you don't need to get on social media. So I'm very wary of it. And the other problem social media has created is, and it's an understandable commercial problem, is that every story about football, for instance, would break in a newspaper. Now it can break on social media. So the football club's attitude is, well, let's break the stories on our social media and not give it to the newspapers or the social media sites. And of course, that breaks down the relationship because journalists no longer feel, actually, you know, we're in bed with a football club and we're all in doing the, you know, we're helping each other. They now see them as opposition. So journalists have become, in my view, a lot more aggressive towards the newspaper because they don't get the help towards the football clubs because they don't get the help they used to get.
Yeah, there was the case of Liverpool. I think there was a damaging story about Liverpool and they just cut out all of the journalists, stopped inviting them to the news conferences, and therefore the standoff got even worse.
Yeah,
so it's not an answer, right?
It's not. And what happens is the journalists just get more and more aggressive. That feeds the social media frenzy. And I think, you know, you've got to be careful because the newspapers, even if they're not selling in the biggest numbers, they're still read online, they're still picked up online. Most of the Google stuff is still the main newspaper stuff, so they're still hugely powerful, and you've got to treat them with respect.
Okay, I think we're there. Thank you very much, Phil, for your time. Thanks, Danny, for your time as well, as ever. This has been The Line, the PR Week sports podcast, which is a collaboration between PR Week and CAKE, the Havas Sport and Entertainment Agency. We're available via prweek.com or iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. And we'll see you next time.
The Line, where sport meets the marketing business.